Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
As this society collapses through peak oil, through continued economic collapse, through continued ecological collapse, I think we can expect and should be prepared for increased violence by men against women, just as we should also be prepared for increased violence by white people against people of color and against the natural world.
That's the voice of Derek Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Derek about what we can expect and what we should prepare for with the ongoing global economic crisis. Stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by prolific author Derek Jensen. Derek is the author of many books, including Endgame and his very latest book, The Knitting Circle, Rapist Annihilation Squad. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's interesting to me that while we seem to have a lot of wars on terror, wars on drug, terrorism is always perceived as violence that happens somewhere out there, outside of the beautiful land of industrialized culture we call the West. Can you talk a little bit about this, and what do you see as the catalyst that leads this mythology on?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think one of the important things that this is to recognize that this culture is based on a rigidly defined and yet often unarticulated hierarchy, where violence done by those higher on the hierarchy, those lower, is usually invisible. And when it is noticed at all, it's fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy, those higher, is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And so this manifests in just bazillions of ways. You know, within my own family, my father is extremely violent, and he beat my siblings and my mother, and he broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy by sending violence up the hierarchy. So that's one example. Another example would be the movie Jaws. We're so scared of sharks, but the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally 20 million to one. Or I live in bear country. I see bears all the time, and I walk through the forest at night without a flashlight, and oh my gosh, aren't you afraid of bears? But there's about one person dies in North America every 2 years from a bear attack. I've seen three bears this summer with broken legs that were trapped, and you know, humans kill bears all the time. And we see this in a bazillion example. Or 9/11 is another example where politicians to this day still, you know, anytime they give a speech, they have to talk about that. But on the other hand, there's about 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. And there are, oh gosh, I believe it's about, I've seen different numbers, between 500,000 and 5 million children die every year as a direct result of capitalism and so-called debt repayment from the non-industrialized nations, the industrialized nations. Or another example that has to do with the current book is that, you know, whenever there's a movie about some guy going to prison, there's always going to be comments in it about rape. And the thing is, the rate at which women are raped in the culture at large is greater than the rate at which men are raped in prison. But because it happens to a man who's higher on the hierarchy, then suddenly there's a tension. And one of the ways I talk about that too is that is contrasting the rape scenes in movies like Dr. Zhivago or Straw Dogs or the torture scene in V for Vendetta, where you have these scenes where on the waterfront where you have women who are being sexually assaulted or assaulted in some other way, and by the end of the scene, they're pulling the man close. They start out pushing him away, and by the end, they're pulling him close, which is a standard pornographic rape fantasy that when women say no, they don't mean no. And, you know, Dr. Zhivago, at the beginning of the scene, Lara is pushing Evgrav away, and by the end of the scene, the shot goes all soft focus, and She puts her arms behind him and pulls him close. And let's contrast that with the rape scene in the movie Deliverance, where it's a man who's being sexually assaulted, and therefore the rape is one of the most horrific rapes that you'll see in film, where, you know, the Ned Beatty character does not reach around to pull the man close and say, "I love you." And that's because it's a man being assaulted. And for me, at least, that's where a lot of the discussion starts.
I want to talk a little bit about that, because while the rape of a woman, as you can say, can be conceived as something she desired or secretly desired, women like bad men, whatever mythology you want to use, the reality is the femicides are on the increase, and they have become virulent in places like the Congo, Mexico, Honduras, where the uprising is being led by women. Post-coup, which the United States consider now a democracy, the femicides, which is sexualized murders, are now part of, you know, the language. They're part of the status quo. So can we talk a little bit about what naturalizes this violence, this virulence of violence that we no longer even describe or talk about in our society, and the economic relationship to that violence?
Well, let's start. Those are fabulous questions. And let's start with the economic basis, or the economic association, and then we'll move back to some of the other questions that you asked. You asked a ton of great questions. And we know what happens when a patriarchal civic society begins to collapse. Oh, let's back up a minute. There's this great study by Peggy Reeve Sanday about rates of rape cross-culturally. Why were some cultures high rape, or are some cultures high rape, and why are some cultures low rape? And a lot of the things she found were pretty obvious. Like, if the culture valorizes men and devalues women, it's probably going to be a high rape culture. If it's highly militarized, it's probably a high rape culture. If it values women and children, if it treats women and children generally well, then it's probably a low-rate culture. Those are pretty obvious. And there's one that's kind of interesting but doesn't have to do with the subject, and one that has very much to do with this. And the one that doesn't have to do quite so much, but I find really interesting, is that if the culture's mythology has primarily a male creative deity, then it's probably a high-rate culture. And if it has primarily a female creator deity, or a couple creator deity, it's probably a lower rape culture. And, you know, obviously all those factors we've said so far are this culture. You know, patriarchal, or male god, valorizes men, highly militaristic, highly competitive, etc. And then there's one other one that was pretty surprising to me, that really blew me away, which is that another indicator of a high rape culture will be a culture that has a history of ecological dislocation in the last several hundred years. And so, you know, if they had a big migration, or if they had a terrible, terrible drought. And all that says to me, okay, so that's what she says, and now here's me interpolating that data, which is what that says to me is that when a culture gets under stress, one of the things that can happen is that men take it out on women. And I'm not excusing it. This is just... it's not excusing it any more than saying that having a male deity excuses it. That is just a marker. And we all know that when you have a community and the mill closes and rates of unemployment go up, rates of domestic violence go up. That's just true. Once again, not to excuse it at all, it's just true. So one of the things that I think we're seeing around the world is as the global economy continues to collapse, when you have a breakdown of patriarchal civic society, one of the things that you can expect is that the rapes will become more frequent and more organized, as we see in the DRC, as we see in many places. And so I actually, whenever I do talks, I almost always bring this up in the talk. So my point is that as this society collapses through peak oil, through continued economic collapse, through continued ecological collapse, I think we can expect and should be prepared for increased violence by men against women, just as we should also be prepared for increased violence by white people against people of color and against the natural world, both, and those are separate categories, obviously. And in one of my books, Culture and Make-Believe, I was talking about trying to figure out why there were so many more lynchings after the American Civil War of African-Americans by white people, why there were so many lynchings after the American Civil War than before. And I came across this line by Nietzsche, which is, one does not hate when one can despise. And suddenly everything opened up for me, which was, as long as you can merely despise those on the lower, who are lower on the cultural hierarchy than you, the hatred that underlies all of your exploitation of them doesn't have to come raging out. But once your perceived entitlement to exploit is threatened through various means, what will happen is that the hatred that you felt for those lower, for those that are you perceive as lower than you on the cultural hierarchy, will turn into this, will come raging out. And so long as the white people had access to the lives and labor of the black people, there was no reason for them to string them up from trees. But once that privilege is no longer supported the way it used to be, then they're going to lash out. And it's the same with this. We can predict the Tea Party. You know, we could predict, as the United States economy collapses, of course the racism is going to become more overt. And it's the same with the femicide, that as the society breaks down, but the hatred of women by men will become more and more overt. And so basically, whenever I do talks about this, I always give two responses. One of them is that, and the responses are different for women and for men. And what I say for women is that I think we need to listen to the words of Andrea Dworkin, who said that her prayer for women of the 21st century is, harden your hearts and learn to kill. And what that says to me is that women need to learn self-defense, and they need to learn self-defense now, and they need to, and the time to learn it is not later, but it's now. And my advice for men is, what we need to do is we need to assume a zero-tolerance policy for male pattern violence against women, and we need to take that on now. I mean, I'm an environmental activist, and I can't tell you how many female environmental activists have told me that they have been sexually assaulted by male environmental activists. And what always happens is that after the assault, if the woman talks about it, then what will happen is the community will get together, and they'll have this coming together meeting of, how are we going to deal? Let's end this conflict. But it wasn't a conflict. I mean, he needs to be, at the very least, kicked out of the community. And we need to assume a zero-tolerance policy. We, as males, we as a community, including females, but especially men, have to take on a zero-tolerance policy for violence against women. And the same is true, of course, for white people with white pattern violence against people of color.
I'm so happy that you brought us there, because while we see the rape of women, you know, being justified, or at times at least rationalized, you know, in the academy, and we have all kinds of studies to tell us the patterns, and you know, and how people become, women in particular, tend to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and people of color just seem to be opening their mouth in the wrong way and speaking things that offend others. And so, you know, they kind of brought it on themselves. I see the relationship.
Yeah, you know, all those women just walking around with hips and breasts and everything, what do they expect?
Exactly.
Sorry, go ahead.
But what I wanted to bring us back is that deep down to me, this is also a fragmentation of our own repudiation of our place of our source, you know, our Mother Earth, right? For indigenous people, the Earth is not just a mythical entity or something we use metaphorically, but it's, you know, we are Earth. We are, you know, all of the elements. So can we talk about the relationship of a hatred towards indigenous cultures and indigenous communities who protect a river or a mountain from the exploitation practices of mining companies, or from the clear-cutting of logging companies, and the relationship, which I see as rape also?
Part of the problem, part of the reason that this culture is not going to undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living, is that within patriarchy, the man defines himself as superior in relation to others who are then defined as inferior and therefore violable. And then how you determine that they are inferior is by violating them. That actually reinforces your own identity. What I'm trying to say is that violation becomes not an action, but an actual identity, so that how you determine your own superiority is by making others inferior and then violating them. So that explains why, for example, this culture has to bomb the moon, why they have to send probes to the deepest folds of the ocean, because everything must be violable. And part of the problem is because there are always new things, then there's always new violations that you have to have. Well, that's part of the problem. Another part of the problem is that there's a great line by R.D. Lang, the psychiatrist, how do you plug a void plugging a void? The problem is that within the patriarchy, we've separated ourselves from all these others. And then, so we're fundamentally existentially lonely. I heard this great line by an astronomer. He was talking about why we have to explore, why they have to explore Mars. And he said, because it will answer that most important question of all, are we all alone? And I was thinking, I got a better question for you, which is, are you crazy? I mean, we're in this world that's surrounded by all these wonderful, beautiful other beings, and he's asking if we're all alone? That's nuts. But of course he is all alone, because he has defined himself as superior and separate from all others. And that's a fundamentally insane way to define yourself, and also inaccurate way to define yourself. And so the only way they can keep it up is by this continued violation. And there's another great line by R.D. Lang. He talks about how if someone remembers something that someone else has forgotten, so he talks about Jack and Jill, and if Jill remembers something that Jack has forgotten and Jack does not want to remember it and does not want to be reminded of it, the best thing for him to do is to get her to forget as well, so she won't keep bringing it up. And so any time the dominant culture will perceive people who are still connected to the land, they will have to destroy them so that they will not be reminded of what they themselves have lost. Is this making sense? Do you want me to try to say this again?
I love it. I think it's beautiful. But I find that not only do we participate in this internalization of violence against others, but by doing so, we re-internalize that violence against ourselves. Because I think the destruction of the earth affects us all, whether we are aware of it or not.
I agree with that to a certain degree, but it doesn't matter to me so much, because I actually don't care how perpetrators are hurting themselves, except insofar as it helps to stop them perpetrating. So, yes, I understand that, you know, rapists are hurting themselves as well, but frankly, I don't care, because my loyalty is 100% with the victims. And if understanding how they're hurting themselves helps us stop them, then that's great. But also, frankly, they're not hurting themselves as much as they're hurting others. I mean, in terms of the natural world, 200 species are being driven extinct. It's not every day, and it's hurting them a lot more. See, here's part of the problem, too. There's this great book by this guy, Lundy Bancroft. It's called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men. And a couple of things. One of them is that I thought I understood a lot about abusers, but he blew me away with some of the stuff he said. For example, he talks about, you know, I always thought that abusers would just lose control. They get so angry they lose control. But he asked some really fundamental questions like, so do they just lose control and beat up a cop? No. Do they, when they're breaking things, do they break their own stuff? No. So his point is they're actually very much in control. They know who it's okay to beat up and who isn't. They know that hierarchy. But his real point is that people who are addicted, you know, it's a cliche that that addicts don't generally change until they hit bottom. And the problem with those who are addicted to power over other people, addicted to exploitation, is that they're not the ones who hit bottom. Everybody else does. This is why perpetrators of domestic violence almost never change, is because they're not the ones who are suffering. everyone else is suffering around them. And this is the same with the dominant culture. This is why there won't be a voluntary transformation, is because we've got it. We, in the first world, we are the global elite. You know, we got our computers, we got our hot showers, and that's all very addictive. And we've got our oil economy, and that's all very addictive. And it's the salmon who are hitting bottom and the oceans who are hitting bottom. And I think that there's a sense in which there's this existential loneliness of being a perpetrator. But that doesn't alter the fact that this culture tries ever more desperately to fill a void, to plug a void, plugging a void, and that costs the rest of the world. That costs the victims everywhere.
Not only, I think, it's not right to justify it. I wasn't trying to justify. I was merely pointing out from the part of those of us who are oppressed in a society that doesn't see anything other than white as superior, in a society that valorizes color and money as the ultimate epic, you know, the apex of the hierarchy. But I was also pointing out that we also tend to internalize that oppression, and without realizing it at times. You know, people blame themselves, and indigenous people say, well, you know, the land has been destroyed, and so once the culture has been completely dismantled, you feel like, you know, what else is there but to compromise, right? Where do we begin to remember? Because I think that's the first lesson of a colonial society that continues today. You know, how do we remember that there are other ways of being other than being a colonized, community that simply follows the status quo, because that's where our jobs are. That's where, that's where the sources, as we perceive them for our life, depend.
I think one of the important things to do is to simply go outside and to start paying attention. You know, in one of my books early on, I wrote about how there are these people who call themselves transhumanists, who believe that humans will eventually meld with machines. And I mean, of course, they're completely nuts. But on the other hand, they're also too late, because it's already happened. Because I think about this a lot, you know. My fingers actually touch plastic more than they touch human flesh. And that's pretty messed up. And I have daily relationships with more, relationships in quotes, with more machines than I do wild plants or animals. And, I mean, think about this right now. How many machines right now are within 20 feet of you? And how many wild animals are within 20 yards of you? And chances are really good for most of us. It's, you know, 10 machines and no wild animals that we know of, that we even pay attention to. And John Livingston wrote this great stuff about how he considers cities to be places of sensory deprivation, not sensory overload, but sensory deprivation, because all of your senses, all of your perceptions come from one source, as opposed to the way we evolved, which is surrounded by all of these non-human others. And what he says is, if you're stuck with all of your perceptions coming from one source, it can become really easy to believe that's the only source that's important. And I think the biggest problem facing us today, frankly, is human supremacism and the belief that humans are fundamentally superior to and separate from everybody else. And I did an interview maybe a month ago with this person who is a complete human supremacist. And one of the things he said is that, why do we care about nature? Humans are the only ones who care about nature being killed, because nature can't appreciate life. And when he said that to me, I was looking out my window, and there was a mother bear with two cubs right then. She was lying in the sun. Her cubs were rolling around on her belly, and they were all just playing. And I said, are you telling me that this bear does not appreciate the sunshine and she doesn't love her children? Is this what you're telling me? And he said, yeah, she doesn't. She's just instincts, and whatever that means. And I said, have you ever actually known a bear? I mean, I've walked side by side through forests with bears. I mean, I know bears. I see them every day. And part of the reason people can say all these really stupid things is because it's all theory. But if you get to know, that's what I said to him. I said, look, I've seen slugs make decisions. You know, you can't tell me that a slug doesn't make decisions. It decides whether it's going to eat this thing or this thing. I've seen them make those decisions. And If you actually have relationships, this isn't going to solve the problems of the culture, because the culture has much bigger problems with this. But individually, I think one of the things that we can do to start to decolonize is to simply listen and to enter into relationship with the others who surround us, and recognize that, you know, so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners perceive the natural world as consisting of resources as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. That trees are every bit as sentient as we are, probably more so, you know, I don't know. Fungi are, and I don't see any reason to presume that we're any smarter than anybody else. And if you go out into the world believing that you're smarter than everybody else, of course they're not going to talk to you. You know, if you and I are having a conversation and you act all the time like you're so much smarter than I am and like I have nothing to say, of course I'm not going to talk to you. But if we go in with an open attitude, of course they'll talk to us.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning. I highly recommend our audience reach your books. Quickly give us your website.
It's derrickjensen.org, www.derrickjensen.org. And let's do this again sometime.
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And blessings to you. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.